Paul and I would like to thank everyone who's here today. We really appreciate the effort people are making to help us. And we look forward to working with you on this cost containment, restructuring the healthcare system through identified savings and other areas that we need to talk about. And why don't we just start by going around and everyone introducing themselves and indicating if you represent some group, you can say so. If you don't, that's fine. You don't have to be representing a group to be here today. So why don't we start with the folks on the right side of the table, and then we'll do the left side. Well, why don't we go ahead with Shannon and Katie? Okay. Everyone might not know you either, so.
Okay. I'm Shannon Anderson, and I'm the committee administrator for Senator Berglund.
I'm Katie Kavanaugh with Senate Council.
And I'm Julie Rosen, Senator Rosen. I live in Fairmont, Minnesota. I have five counties down there, and I'm fortunate to sit with Senator Berglund on our committee.
Tara Erickson, I'm a contract lobbyist, and I have a few healthcare clients.
Marnie Moore, I'm a lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman, and I'm also a law student focusing on health law.
Yiska Braca, I'm with the Center for Urban Health at Hennepin County Medical Center.
Pete Benner, I spent 30 years working for AFSCME in Minnesota. I'm now retired from them, doing some consulting work back on healthcare, among other things. I'm also on the boards of ICSI and Community Measurement.
And I'm Representative Diane Loeffler, and I'll attend as I'm able.
State Representative Paul Thiessen from Minneapolis, and also represent Richfield. And I just should say, my Jen McNerney is my committee administrator, who I don't think is going to be staffing this group, but just so people know who she is as well. In the back of the room, somewhere.
David Godfrey, Senate Fiscal.
All right, Jim Abler, I think timing is everything, and I'm glad to be here.
I'm Charlie Fazio. I'm a physician in emergency medicine, but I work full-time at Medica as their chief medical officer and also serve on the community measurement and ICSI boards with Pete Benner.
I'm Larry Krasanik. I'm the chief financial officer at Hennepin County Medical Center.
I'm Jonathan Watson with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We have 18 community health centers in the state. About 40% of our patients are uninsured and another 40% on Medicaid or public assistance.
Holly Roden, I'm with the Service Employees International Union.
Hi, I'm Donna Zimmerman from Health Partners Government and Community Relations, and I work a lot there with community health initiatives, government programs, issues, general public policy, and then issues related to the uninsured through our work at Regions.
Hi, I'm Nancy Nelson, and I'm Chief Actuary for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota.
Tom Huntley, State Rep from Duluth. I'm not on this work group, but I have no other life.
Well, Tom, we'll try and make it exciting for you then. planned this meeting out today basically to try to get some information, and so you have a number of materials in your packets, and we're going to start with the Department of Health. We asked them to come and talk with us a little bit about the characteristics of Minnesota's uninsured who are not eligible for our public programs. We know there's quite a few uninsured who are eligible, but today we thought we'd focus on those who are not eligible. April, do you want to come up to the table then? And this is what the handout looks like for this presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the work group. My name is April Todd Malmuth.
If you can pull the microphone over to your face closer, because...
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
That helps.
As I was saying, my name is April Todd Malmuth. I'm the Assistant Director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. And as Senator Berglund had mentioned, we were asked to come over and describe to you the characteristics of the uninsured in Minnesota that are not eligible for public programs in the state. And I thought it would be a good idea to, in this presentation, give you a little bit of background on insurance trends in Minnesota, just because some of you may not know this information, may be new to this information, and then go into characteristics of the uninsured and particular groups of the uninsured so that you get a comparison of the characteristics of those that are eligible for employer coverage, public programs, and those that are not eligible for either type of that coverage. And then later on, there's also some information of particular interest on why these groups are not enrolled in coverage. So just a brief background. As some of you may know, the uninsurance rate in Minnesota has increased since 2001. This is the first increase that we've had in the uninsurance rate in Minnesota over the last 10 years. This increase has represented approximately an increase of 100,000 uninsured people in the state. And there are a few reasons for why the uninsurance rate has increased in the state. One of them is that we have seen a decline in employer-based coverage, a significant decline from 2001 to 2004. And there are a few reasons for this decline. One of the reasons is that we have noticed a decline just in general employment, the percent of Minnesotans that are employed. We have also noticed that there has been a change in the characteristics of employment. So, for example, there are quite a few more people in the state that are employed in temporary and seasonal jobs, and also for smaller employers, less likely to offer coverage. We have also noticed that the percent of people that just have access to employer coverage has declined, and eligibility for that coverage has declined. There's been some change in eligibility for coverage, likely related to the temporary seasonal work, hours worked, those types of things. We have not noticed a decline in take-up, so most of the drop in employer-based coverage we believe is related to a decline in access to employer-based coverage. In response to that decline in employer-based coverage, we have seen an increase in public program enrollment during this period of time, but the increase was not large enough to offset the much larger decline in employer-based coverage, so we did see an increase in the uninsured from 5.7% in 2001 to 7.4% in 2004. And so now getting into the characteristics of this uninsured population and how it has changed over time. What you'll see on this slide is a depiction of the types of coverage that the uninsured may potentially be eligible for. The first two bars represent the percent of the population that is eligible for employer-based coverage and not taking up that coverage. It's been roughly about one-fifth of the population in Minnesota for quite a few years, and it's also roughly the same percentage nationwide. So it's fairly consistent nationally and in Minnesota. The next two bars on this slide show the percent of the population that's potentially eligible for public programs. And this has increased over time. And one of the main reasons for this increase from 2001 to 2004 is that we have seen a shift in the income distribution of the uninsured and a downward shift. So a much larger percentage of the uninsured have lower incomes in 2004 than they did in 2001, making them more likely to be eligible for public programs. So as a result of employer-based coverage and the potentially eligible, what's remaining is the percentage that are not eligible for employer-based coverage or a public program. And that has declined from 2001 to 2004, largely because of the increase in the percent that are potentially publicly eligible. The one thing that I also want to mention about this slide is that you will notice that if you add these three groups together, they are larger than 100%. And the reason for that is that there are a small percentage of people, largely kids and the very low income, that do have access to employer coverage and are eligible for public programs just because their incomes are so low. This next slide just gives you some puts the information from the prior slide into numbers of people. And so that you will see over time how the number of people eligible for employer coverage that are uninsured has changed and how the potentially publicly eligible has increased quite a bit and the not eligible for public programs, which I'll focus on a little more detail as we get on, is roughly around 100,000 people. This slide provides some information on the age distribution of these three groups. And what you'll see from this slide is that those that are not eligible for public programs or employer-based coverage tend to be quite a bit older, most of them over the age of 35, which is quite a bit different than the other two groups. And this next slide provides some information on the income distribution of these three uninsured groups. And what you'll see on this slide is that, you know, the employer eligible, that income distribution is fairly similar to what the distribution is for all uninsured Minnesotans. And as you would expect, the potentially publicly eligible group has lower incomes, because that's the defines what they're eligible for are the income limits. Those that are not eligible for public or employer-based coverage tend to be quite a bit higher income groups. As you'll see, slightly more than a third of this group has incomes above 400% of the poverty level. On this next slide, I just wanted to mention briefly some of the differences in employment characteristics between these three groups. And there are not a whole lot of differences in employer characteristics. The uninsured Minnesotans that are eligible for employer-based coverage tend to be slightly more likely to be employed than other uninsured groups, and that's to be expected since they're eligible for employer-based coverage. But the only other difference between these groups is that those that are not eligible for public or employer-based coverage tend to be they're much more likely to be sole proprietors. So 16.5% of those not eligible for coverage are sole proprietors, meaning they're self-employed, don't have any employees. But in terms of hours worked and size of employer, all of those distributions among these three groups are fairly similar. So now getting into some reasons for why these three uninsured groups are not enrolled in coverage. And not surprisingly, if you look at those that are eligible for employer-based coverage, over two-thirds of them say that they are not enrolled because they can't afford it. The other large category on this chart, the 15.4%, which is other, that category, we know that they're eligible. They've told us they're eligible, but they haven't given us a lot of them haven't given us a reasons for why they have not taken up coverage, or else it's a small reason that doesn't match in the other categories. This next slide provides some information on we ask questions of people who are uninsured if they have knowledge of public programs and if they would be willing to enroll if they were eligible. And this is particularly interesting because you'll see that roughly 60% of the uninsured that we have determined are potentially eligible for public programs have at some point asked for or been given information about one of Minnesota's public programs. So they have some knowledge of the program. And then if you ask them, well, would you enroll if you were eligible? And, you know, roughly 90% of them say that they would enroll if they were eligible, and that percentage increases if you ask them, well, would you enroll if it were free? And so you have a large percentage of people who say that they would enroll if they were eligible, and they do have knowledge of the programs. And so the next question is, well, why are they not enrolling in coverage? And this is a question we have not yet asked, but we will be asking it on our 2007 survey so that we can get information on this. But the reasons for this could likely be related to the fact that at the time of the survey they weren't sick, or they didn't think that they needed coverage, so why should they be enrolled? Or they may not be eligible for the program for reasons that we do not ask for in our survey, for example, things related to assets. Or they may not think that they are eligible, even though we determine that they likely are. This next slide provides information on the reason why the uninsured that are not eligible for employer-based coverage or a public program, why they do not enroll, and a much larger percentage of this group says that they can't afford it, which somewhat makes sense because, as you will notice from the earlier slides, this is a much older group. So the types of premiums that they would be facing in the individual market are going to be on that higher end of that premium range. So even though their incomes are a little higher than the other groups, the premiums that they would face in the individual market are also quite a bit higher. So just to summarize the information that I've presented, roughly one-fifth of the uninsured have access to employer-based coverage but are not enrolled, and the primary reason is cost. 60% of the uninsured are potentially eligible for public programs but have not enrolled, and this percentage has increased over time due to the shift in the income distribution of the uninsured. And the majority of this population does have knowledge of public programs and would enroll if they were eligible. And lastly, roughly one-fourth of the uninsured do not have access to employer or public coverage. And this group tends to be older, have higher incomes, and they're more likely to be sole proprietors than the other groups. And again, the primary reason for this group not purchasing their own coverage through the individual market is the cost that they would face in doing so. That's the end of the presentation, and I would be open to any questions that you have.
if we look at the chart that is kind of in the middle of the packet and is titled Income Distribution of the Uninsured by Eligibility Status. The third column where you've got people by income who are not eligible, do you have a breakdown of that 200 to 400%?
We can provide that for you.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful to know which are between 2 and 300 and which are between 3 and how many are between 3 and 400% of poverty. Are there other questions?
Can I just ask one quick one? Yeah. You said on the employment characteristics of the uninsured, you said the hours worked are similar across all groups, so that includes the eligible for public program groups?
Yes.
Okay.
Other questions? Yes.
In your survey, are you able to tease out employed people who work multiple part-time jobs and none of which they are eligible for their employer insurance?
Yes, we do ask them how many hours they work at their primary job, which is what we were analyzing for this analysis. But we also ask them how many jobs they work and how many hours they work at all of their jobs. So that is something that we can tease out.
And where would someone like that fit in terms of the categories? Would that be someone deemed not eligible?
Not eligible, they would not be eligible for employer-based coverage if they weren't eligible through their work. If their income was low enough for them to be eligible for public programs, they would be in that category. If they were not eligible for public programs, they would have been in that third category of not eligible.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Just one. April, when your survey looked at people who had not purchased in the individual market because of the cost, did you have a sense underlying that whether those people had researched their options or just responded to the question? Do we know anything about whether they had researched different options and found them to be not affordable? Or
we have not asked that level of detail.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions? No, thank you very much. Next, we're going to receive some information on anticipated savings due to administrative uniformity. And Jim Golden, the Director of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health, will help us with this overview.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. I think what I have been asked to talk about today is some of the potential savings and costs associated with the administrative simplification that was passed last session in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. One of the things, and you do have a handout as well as the slides, there are two of them because this, when I copied this in the first one, the premiums enrollment didn't show, so there are two things here. But I thought what might be helpful in understanding some of the costs and savings might be to just be helpful to understand what it is that was passed and where there are opportunities for savings to be had. When we talk about the administrative transactions associated with the healthcare, we're generally talking about this circle here, which really starts kind of in the upper right-hand corner with premium payments and enrollments. These would be transactions generally between an employer and a health plan or an enrollee and their health plan. It could be between an employer and their TPA. At some point, the patient is likely to go to seek services at a facility. That provider is going to want to know if they're eligible for benefits. They will have some type of query to the health plan or the TPA to check eligibility. There may be some need for a referral, prior authorization, perhaps a first report of injury. At some point, the provider is going to provide services to that patient. Once those services are provided, there will be a claim that goes from that provider to the health plan or TPA. The provider may want to know kind of what the status of that is at a certain point after it's been submitted. That's another possible transaction that can occur. The health plan may have some questions or maybe something about the visit that requires some special type of paperwork that could go with the claim. That would be a potential claim attachment. At some point, that claim will be resolved, adjudicated, and that the next part will be a remittance advice. This is some information that goes back to the healthcare provider that explains how the claim was addressed. And then finally, what we have there is EFT, but that's really a payment piece where the health plan or TPA pays the provider. What we did last session is we passed some legislation that is known as the Uniform Electronic Transaction and Implementation Guide Standards. Really what this does is it focuses on three of those transactions that I just showed you and really does two significant things. First, it requires that the three transactions must be exchanged electronically. So we're no longer at a certain point going to be able to do those transactions via paper. They will have to happen electronically. And then there will also be a single standard for both the content and the format, and the implementation of that is in 2009. Just to tie back to the circle that you just saw, the three areas where we will be focusing in is in the eligibility, determining if a patient is eligible for services, claim submission, and then the payment and remittance advice that explains how that has been adjudicated. One question you might have is, well, don't we have a national standard with the HIPAA for these various transactions? Well, we do, but the feds put together a non-standard standard. And what I mean by that is that there is a standard, but for any organization, any health plan or provider to implement that, there's option points in that some of the variables are situational, some of them are optional. So to implement it, a health plan really needs to put what's called a companion guide together. And that companion guide really details how to use that standard. Well, the difficulty is that health plans have put together different companion guides. So if you're a provider needing to submit one of these transactions, you have to make sure to use the appropriate companion guide to use the standard appropriately. And it adds quite a lot of complexity to the system. And so what we're doing here is when we say a single standard, really it would be one companion guide that would apply to everyone. Who does this apply to? It really applies to everyone. On the healthcare provider side, it really applies to all providers, anyone who either provides healthcare services for a fee or is eligible to bill Medicaid, whether or not they are actually being billed. Then also we have group purchaser. That is basically every type of payer imaginable. It includes all health plans, insurance companies, public programs. It also would include TPAs. It would include others who might not be included under federal regulations, such as work comp, the medical component of auto insurance, and the medical component of property and casualty. So this is, if you're paying a medical bill, at the moment, you would be covered by these requirements. What's the timeline for this? Of course, what we need to do to implement this statute is we need to develop in a community way the actual standards, the companion guides that we will all be required to use. For each of the three areas, the Commissioner of Health is required to do a rule promulgation. Those occur in 2008 between January and December. And although we promulgate them then, once we put the rules out there, providers and health plans have 1 year to change over their systems, to train their staff, to really prepare to do this. So 1 year after the rule is promulgated, then there's a need to implement. Although you only see three boxes, I would simply point out claims is actually much larger than you might think. There's a separate standard or companion guide that needs to be used for institutional, which would be facilities, professional, dental, and pharmacy. So there's actually a little bit more here than just meets the eye at first blush. Where are there opportunities for savings in this? I think it really is helpful to think about the fact that we're doing two things. One, we're going electronic. Second, we're using a single standard. When you take a look at the fact that it's a single standard, in general, the big beneficiaries of this will be the providers. They're the ones that are having to deal with many different standards and dealing with the different health plans. And some of their opportunities, in particular, for savings would be it will be much less expensive to do staff training. There will be less effort involved in needing to stay current with regard to the various payer requirements. Right now, every time a payer has a change, there's a need to document that, make sure it gets incorporated into your software or your processes. It will be easier to maintain some of the software. That would be less staffing, less programming costs, perhaps less vendor costs associated with that. Presumably, there will be fewer transactions that are rejected at the health plan from having sent over the wrong format because you used one plan's format and sent it to a different plan. At the plan level, because everyone would be asking for the same type of format, it should help to facilitate coordination of benefit across different payers when they need to exchange that claim data. And the other opportunity here is that this really helps to enable other types of simplification that we will be interested in the future. And I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. The second opportunity for savings comes from the fact that we are doing this electronically. Electronic claims are just plain less expensive to process than our paper claims. There are a number of reasons for this, and a little later I have some numbers that kind of show some general ranges. But where's the savings here? Well, there's some reduced data entry across trading partners. Once the data is entered in electronically at the provider, it just stays entered electronically, and there's no need to rekey that. There's no need to do other types of things like that. It also eliminates mailing and telephone costs. No need to open this, enter it in, scan data in after it's been mailed. It facilitates faster submission, verification of the information, and then payment. So it moves the whole process along in time and helps to facilitate the speed of that. And again, this will also help to facilitate some other things we might be interested in. For example, moving all payments electronically. Although it's not part of this legislation, we are all doing electronic banking in our personal lives. Most businesses are doing quite a lot of it. This helps to facilitate this, and it's a necessary step. There are some other benefits as well. One of the questions is savings. Great, those are the opportunities for savings. How much is there really there? I think that was part of the question. Well, it's very difficult to calculate that, and there are a number of reasons why it's difficult. The savings are really spread across a large number of different organizations. On the provider side, you literally have thousands and thousands of providers who will be seeing some type of savings in a way, but the problem is it's very difficult to try to capture what those savings are, and even if it's a small or modest amount of savings for many of the providers, when you multiply it by thousands, it becomes a much larger number. Additionally, there's some costs that will be associated with this that are hard to get as well. One of the things that we have been working on is actually implementing the statute, so we don't have some of the more detailed costs, but I did find some materials that I thought might be instructive on this. With regard to eligibility verification, the Council of Health Plans and the Minnesota Hospital Association had done some work on this last year, and one of the things that they looked at was just time spent on the telephone. This is not actually conducting the whole transaction. This is just time spent on the telephone working to try to resolve these issues. For the payers, being able to eliminate that time has the opportunity to save somewhere between $1.4 and $1.7 million. On the providers, it's somewhere between $4 and $7 million annually. Again, I think the difference that you see between the payers and providers is there's just a lot of providers that need to do this. On the third one, remittance advice, explaining how a claim has been adjudicated. Again, just looking at telephone time and clarifying how the claim has been adjudicated, the payers estimate that there's approximately $1 million annually worth of savings in that. Providers are, again, at $4 to $7 million. Another example that helps you kind of get a sense of where some of the claims savings would be. If a payer, this is information that comes from the America's Health Insurance Plans. They did a survey in 2006. This is national data. It's not Minnesota-specific data. But what they did is they took a look at if a health plan receives a clean electronic claim, what's the cost of processing that? Nationally, the average cost of processing that claim was 85 cents. If they receive that same claim clean on paper, the average cost is 58 cents. If my math isn't failing me, I believe that's 73 cents per claim difference that you see there. The other thing that they noted in this is that if you have a suspended claim, a claim that has some issues that need to be addressed, perhaps it's a duplicate, perhaps it doesn't have all of the information it's supposed to, a suspended claim averages about $2.05 to process. So when you start to look at that, there are opportunities to do significant savings. Unfortunately, there are some costs associated with this. I think the good news is most of these costs are one time. When looking at the standard, because people need to use the single standard, obviously there's going to need to be some significant changes. Practically everyone will need to do some system changes. So there's programming, there's training of staff. In the transition, you might see some increase in suspended claims, which have a higher cost than clean claims. So from that standpoint, you might see a temporary increase. Likewise, there might be some temporary increase in customer service types of costs. I think the good news is most of these costs are one-time costs. Once we actually get the system implemented, we should see that most of the costs start to go away, and we should start to recognize the savings that are anticipated. Likewise, in the fact that it's becoming electronic, some of the costs there, particularly for small providers who may not be doing electronic claims now, there's going to be some computer equipment, perhaps the need to use a clearinghouse to do some of this electronically. Again, some training of staff. There may be some difficulties associated with some of the bandwidth, particularly in the very rural areas, to try to do this electronically. That's something that we're watching. I know that's an interest of the Department of Human Services as well. And also there will be some costs for the payers in developing provider portals for small providers who want to do this in a direct entry kind of way, as opposed to a more complicated manner of doing it with some of the transactions. Good news, again, these are mainly one-time costs. One of the other things that I'd like to just point out is that we often talk about what are the savings, what are the costs associated with this. Some of the savings that we achieve here might be best spent in actually continuing on in some of these ideas, because one of the advantages of going to both electronic and a single standard is that's really a necessary first step for some of the other things that we might like to do. For example, some of the other opportunities around simplification and uniformity would be a single provider portal. This would be very similar to the Utah model, UHIN, where they simply have a single portal that's where all claims are submitted through. One way to think of that is as a post office where a claim comes in, verified that it's clean, and then sent off to the appropriate payer. That actually has some savings in that every payer doesn't have to do this. If there are changes in some of the federal standards, you change it once at the single portal. Doesn't require quite so as much of the changes at each of the payers. One of the other things that I can say is Minnesota is really one of the first states that have embarked upon having these single companion guides that are required under state law. After we passed it, we have heard that 5 to 7 other states are now considering a very similar type of law. What we're hoping is that as other states start to do this, that will slowly reduce down the number of variations on the one federal standard, and that we can have collaborations with states so that maybe initially we have Medicare and the 50 states, but then we start to get down to fewer and fewer standards, which will really start to get even greater savings as we deal with out-of-state providers and out-of-state payers. This also is a necessary step for electronic fund transfer that I talked about earlier. And it's also a necessary step for something such as real-time claims processing. The advantage of real-time's claim processing is it starts to make the whole thing much more like a routine retail transaction. A patient comes in, provider wants to know, am I going to get paid for providing the services? They check eligibility on the spot. They provide the services. They submit a claim. They can tell the patient on the spot, this is what you're going to need to pay. They can collect that. The providers are much happier, and it gets done. So with that, I would be more than happy to take your questions.
Questions? Representative Abler.
I'll try to keep my list short. I remember this was discussed last year, and it sounds, well, I'm a little more nervous having heard this than I was last year. But we heard about ERISA this morning.
Yes.
Can we make ERISA groups do this?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I think the question is maybe, but let me explain why that question may not be quite as significant as it seems. I think what really you're asking is, can we make the TPAs who are serving as the administrators for the self-funded plans do this? And if we look across at who those TPAs are, many of the TPAs are health plans that are already required to comply with this. We have every reason to believe that not only will they want to, they will gladly comply because this will keep standardization in their entire business. Likewise, in the business community, they want to see standardization. They want to see savings. They're likely to ask their TPAs to do this as well. I'm not an attorney. I don't think we have a clean answer to your question of can we ask the ERISA plans to do this. It is our belief that we can require TPAs to do this. If some self-funded plan was actually doing their own claims processing, they may very well not be subject to this, but I'm not sure that I know of any large employers that are actually doing that.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, one of the challenges, because the eligibility for some of those self-insureds as a provider is really hard for us. We check all our eligibilities. HMOs are great, Medica, outstanding, you know, the rest of them. The HMOs are pretty good, and the fully insureds are pretty good. But when you get to the self-insured, it's really hard, and that's one of your goals, I know. And can you comment on the average cost for a clinic to do this? What do you think it's going to really cost for my clinic or some other or some big hospital or some poor rural hospital to do this? Have you anticipated those costs?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, unfortunately, I don't have any number on that. I think it would vary greatly. I think for some of the very small clinics, in talking with various people, what we would expect is, for example, you might have an employee who wears multiple hats. Perhaps they're spending 60% of their time doing some billing. They're spending 30% of their time doing reception work and 10% doing other activities. What we might expect to see is that after something like this, maybe they're doing 25% of their time on billing and administrative activities. They still have their 30% at the reception, but now you have 45% of their time that could be used for other activities. I think one of the difficulties is how do you capture that? Not really sure. What we have anecdotally from Utah, for example, is that there have been some very real savings associated with reducing the complexity, even for the smalls. The other thing I would say, Representative Abler, is there's probably a need to look at this both in the short term and in the long term. I think in the short term, there probably are some very real costs for everyone that needs to comply. In the long term, we should all recognize the savings across both providers and payers.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Rosen.
I was wondering about your inadequate bandwidth statement. Is that verified, or is that apparently Minnesota is on the cusp or the cutting edge of all this? So, is that verified in the state that there is inadequate bandwidth throughout some of the parts of Greater Minnesota? Because I challenge that. I think. Have you done some research? Is what I'm saying, or is that just assuming that we do have inadequate bandwidth?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. I have not done research. I can tell you where we also see this exact same issue, and we could certainly get you perhaps more information. In the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, which is also in our division, they have been looking quite a lot at issues of telemedicine and telehealth. We have some anecdotal evidence on that there are some bandwidth issues in certain parts of the state, particularly once you get outside of the city. I think Representative Otremba has raised some of those issues through some of her committees. But I don't have the research, but we do have some that could, and we can get you some information on that.
Madam Chair, there is an excellent study by Dr. Jack Geller from Center for Rural Policy that has studied this issue, so that would be a source.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Thiessen?
Thank you. Just two quick questions. First, you said Utah has already documented some of the savings from this.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I'm not sure they've documented it. What we generally find is that most of it is anecdotal. So we have contacted them. We haven't gotten anything that we could confirm as real numbers.
Okay. And the other question is, what in order to kind of capture some of these savings or figure out what they are, what information do you think we would really need to collect, and do we have the capacity to collect some of that information?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think that in collecting that data, it really needs to be looked at in two spots. One would be on the payer side, where you have a smaller number of organizations. I suspect that they actually collect some of this and probably would be able to supply some of that information once they have a better sense of what some of their costs would be. With regard to some of the providers, I think that's particularly difficult. I know that the Hospital Association, for example, worked on it and got some of those numbers. You know, we could look at ways that we might collect that through some of our routine collections. There might be some opportunities to work with some of the associations to do a survey of their members and then try to extrapolate that in some ways. So that might be some opportunities once we start getting closer to the implementation phase between 2008 and 2009.
Okay. Other questions?
Yeah. Chair, for a question. Thank you. Dr. Fuller, I didn't listen to Representative Thiessen's question, but do you have plans on continuing to finish out the circle as far as right now we're just going to be working on eligibility claims and remittance payments. Are you going to be able to have plans for the future for the rest of the?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, there is a group. For example, the group that is working to put together this standard is a group that is known as the Minnesota Administrative Uniformity Committee. It is made up of payers and providers and state agencies. That group, I believe, and some others will make some recommendations with regard to where the next best opportunities are. So there's probably quite a lot of opportunities raised to the point that Representative Abler mentioned around enrollment. One of the difficulties with eligibility, for example, is if a TPA or a health plan doesn't have current enrollment data because an employer may have 2 to 5 months to get that information correct, that TPA or health plan has a difficulty in providing accurate information to the plans, or I'm sorry, to the providers. So there might be a number of spots where there are opportunities around the circle and perhaps even more in depth on some of these. So I believe there's a great interest in continuing this work. At this point, I don't think we have a sense of exactly what the best next steps are.
Other questions? Have we been able to identify whether we believe over time there will be savings due to this administrative simplification in our public programs?
Madam Chair, yes. We do believe that there will be savings over time. I think, as an example, the Department of Human Services estimates that they have approximately 1 million paper claims annually right now. So, for example, there would be opportunities to move those to electronic and to save some money there, for example. I think some of the questions with that would be, what percentage of those claims can you really get electronic? How do you work with the small providers to use their types of systems? What types of trainings do you have around that? and make sure that they have those kinds of information. But that would be an example of where I think they hope to capture some of those savings.
Any other questions? Representative Loeffler.
On that same issue, the public programs, Madam Chair and Mr. Olden, I've always heard that there's a real issue with the eligibilities from the provider perspective and being able to get real-time accurate eligibility information from people who are in public programs, and that there's always sort of some lag time. Some hospitals I know were subscribing to a private service that was trying to accelerate that, which is another cost in the system when you have them paying for a different private system just to get access to public information. So that might be an area that we should have you and DHS exploring further.
We would be more than happy to pass that along and work with them on that.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you, committee.
Vicki Kunrath. Talk about savings that may happen as a result of pay for performance.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Vicki Kunrath from the Department of Human Services. I'm Director of Performance Measurement and Quality Improvement. And I understand the question is how have we approached estimation of cost savings for our pay for performance initiative? I described it earlier this morning, and we are, you know, just starting this initiative. The way we approached estimating cost savings is that, particularly for diabetes as an example, our basic estimate was that we're starting with about 5% of our enrollees are getting optimum diabetic care. Now, frankly, with the contract with the chart reviews and other more information, we'll confirm indeed if that's the base where we're starting. Also, because we don't have any history, we assumed in our fiscal note that we could conservatively expect a 3 percentage point improvement in the share of our enrollees that are getting optimum diabetic care and optimum cardiac care each year. We will certainly modify those projections over time after we get some real history, but our forecaster, George Hoffman, said that he wants to be very cautious but optimistic in his projections to that end. So cautious and optimistic, he expects an expansion of 3 percentage points. In looking at the cost benefits and looking at available analysis and studies, there's generally certain characteristics about those studies. When they're covering chronic disease. One, generally the intervention, in this case optimum chronic disease care, is available to the majority of the population. That's not the case with us today. The time frame is also necessarily long term, let's say 8 years or more for diabetic care, and maybe a shorter time for cardiac care. And the majority of the savings are real good, substantial savings that could be projected from those studies are often from lower hospital costs associated with a reduction in the number and severity of complications associated with these chronic diseases. None of these features exist today for us because we are just starting. We still went ahead and made a projection of some cost impact. So what we did was not with a focus on hospital savings, because that's further term, further out. And what we projected for you for our fiscal note during session was the next 4 years, just as we're starting this program. So we did an estimate based on the total cost of diabetic care without any expectation of an impact on hospital costs, and also because of the population size was so low. So our projected savings to the general fund, and so this is, you know, half the cost because Medicaid, for example, pays 50%. We expect fiscal year 2010 and 11 to have respectively $250,000 and $400,000 in savings as a result of the expansion of optimum care to the public population. The net result, though, because this is an investment by the rewards to providers, the net cost is $700,000 each year in 2010 and 2011. So this isn't a net savings at this point. The other complication in Minnesota's investment around chronic diseases, in some cases, depending on the health status and care starts.
Ms. Quinnerth, could I just ask you to back up and repeat those numbers?
Sure. It's also in the fiscal note from session. For 2010, the health impact, the savings, for both the diabetic initiative and the cardiac care would be about $250,000, and in 2011 about $400,000. Cost to the general fund net is about $750,000 each year in 2010 and 2011.
So do we anticipate ever a time when it would at least pay for itself?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. We anticipate that it'll pay for itself because it is an initiative across the whole healthcare delivery system. And if we can do this for several years and continue to expand optimum care for our clients over time, we expect that it may be 8-10 years out, we will more than pay for itself. Now, one complication of that is what I was starting to describe before, is depending on the age in which our clients are most at risk for those costly complications, if that hits when they're over 65, the savings will go to the Medicare administration, not to us, not to the state of Minnesota. So that is part of the complication of calculating an estimate of savings to our general fund, is how long the optimum care is provided to what share of the population, and when we can head off or have an impact on the reduction of those very costly complications, the vascular related, their blindness, kidney failure, amputations, many, many cardiac complications. So that's the challenge of estimating at this point.
Are there questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do your estimates just look at the health savings? Is that all you can look at? As opposed to, you know, if someone's not blind, they can perhaps work, you know, more hours and do all those kinds of, you know, Can we calculate any of those kind of savings?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, at this point, this was just healthcare cost savings. I think over time, we can look at that, depending on the age and stuff.
Do we ever do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, generally, it's just to the checkbook we're kind of focusing on. Larger studies, national studies, often do that sort of social impact and cover more checkbooks than the general fund. But yes, but generally our forecasts are just about the healthcare cost accounts.
Right. So, and Madam Chair, so when it's not just the checkbook being the general fund, it's the checkbook being the general fund part that pays for healthcare.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
And your savings. Again, repeat that, at 65, it goes to the federal government, basically.
The Medicare Corporation, because, Madam Chair, because at that point, I mean, Medicare is paying for outpatient care and hospital care. So any savings in hospital costs, for example, would be on their dime.
Does your figures break down as far as age groups, as far as the diabetic or cardiovascular? Are they broken down to age groups where you could perhaps make an impact earlier at an age group?
Madam Chair, at this point, Senator Rosen, it'll depend how long which age cohort gets optimum diabetic care for a long enough period of time. The calculation, I gave you the rolled up numbers, the calculation did slice by the components of our budget, you know, how much we appropriate to the elderly and disabled, how much we appropriate to younger family adults, things like that. So it was calculated along those lines. But as we monitor over time, we intend to look at who is receiving optimum care, which age cohort, what is their cost, what is their service use today over time to see exactly what the results are.
Ms. Kunrath, you know, originally when this concept was being presented to members of the legislature, it was being presented by the Business Partnership, and they had looked at a model that was used elsewhere, doing a similar sort of thing by all of the large businesses picking the same things to measure and pay for performance. And they were showing cost savings in the healthcare arena alone for employed persons within 2 years, so that the investment was really paying for itself in a very short period of time. And I'm just wondering why we, I mean, yes, we have a further way to go, but we also have a much greater opportunity for improvement in the public sector.
Madam Chair, I think I saw some information on the study you may be referring to, and it did assume that the optimum care was available to the larger part of the population, not such a small part of the population, and the time frame, I can't explain that difference. I think we weren't comfortable in making estimates similar to that. What the information we had, all we had was some overheads. We didn't have a lot of details from that study. We can go back and try to get the full study and answer you more fully on that.
I'd appreciate that. Other questions? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Kunrath, did your savings include doer expenses
and state employees? Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, no, they do not. This is just for the Department of Human Services budget and population. DOER is a year ahead of us in terms of participating in the diabetic reward, but I don't have their figures.
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to say, certainly businesses spend a lot of money on keeping our employees healthy.
Well, maybe we
could pay off to them.
I mean, maybe we could find out if DOER is projecting any savings, how far off their savings are. Other questions? Yes, Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Ms. Kunrath, I'm wondering, and I think about who's in the public programs, and we tilt towards younger adults with children at home and seniors and some small amount of disabled. I mean, they're significant, but so our public programs really don't have that sort of midlife group that's starting to come into those chronic issues, and I'm wondering if you might want to spend some time and give us some insight on, given the unique demographics of who's on public programs currently, if in the public programs there might be some more fruitful tracks than might be available to an employer who's covering a much broader range of demographics for potential savings. I'm just wondering if part of what the conservative numbers is also just we're not seeing people in that, you know, 50 to 65 age range that tends to be when you start to really build up those chronic numbers.
Representative Loeffler, I would expect that if you looked at the folks that are being served in our public programs compared to an employed population, for example, that you would find more people with diabetes in our cohorts, simply because we have more people of color, we have more people with disabilities, we have more people who have multiple chronic conditions, we have more people taking medications that can bring on diabetes.
Madam Chair, our rates of diabetes are higher than in the commercial population. For our clients that are 76 and above, you know, pure Medicare, the rate of diabetes is 20%. For our 18 to 75-year-old, our rate is 7.5%, which is higher than the general adult commercial rate. So we do have more.
And so potentially if we had more of those people receiving optimal care, we would have opportunity to have more savings because of less progression of the disease.
That's the hope.
Other questions? If not, we'll look forward to getting more information from you.
Thank you.
Randy Chun has done some work about what other states have determined affordability to be.
Madam Chair, Randy Chun with the Health Research Department. I'll be working off a handout titled Background Materials, A Definition of Affordable Healthcare. And this provides a brief description of some of the other handouts that are in your packet on this topic. Staff were asked to provide information on how other states define affordable health coverage. So far, Massachusetts is the only state that has adopted a formal and explicit definition of affordability. The Massachusetts health care reform law requires state residents who are age 18 or over to purchase and maintain health coverage if this health coverage is affordable. And the effective date of this provision was July 1st of 2007. So I'd like to spend my time just briefly going over two of the documents in the packet, and you can follow along on this handout. First, it's the definition of affordability adopted by the Commonwealth, by the Health Connector Board. And second, it would be a working paper that was presented to the board that provides an overview of three ways to determine what is affordable. So the first document with the definition is titled Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority Affordability and Premium Schedules, June of 2007. This document provides a definition of affordability that was adopted by the Connector Authority in June. And this is a four-part definition. First, persons who are eligible for the Commonwealth Care Health Insurance Program are deemed eligible to afford insurance. And Commonwealth Care is a subsidized health care insurance program for uninsured adults with incomes up to 300% of poverty. And those with incomes between 100 and 300% pay premiums based on a sliding scale. The sliding scale premiums for this program are sort of coordinated with the definition of affordability. Second part is that those who are not eligible for Commonwealth care and with incomes below specified levels are deemed to not be able to afford insurance and are therefore exempt from the mandate to have health coverage. And these levels are $15,315 for individuals, $20,350 for married couples, $25,755 for families. For individuals and married couples, these amounts are about 150% of the federal poverty guidelines and will vary a bit with, for the families depending upon the family's household size. And then part three of the definition is that individuals with incomes above specified levels are deemed able to afford coverage and are subject to the penalty, you know, if they don't purchase this or maintain this coverage. These levels are $50,000 for individuals, $80,000 for married couples, and $110,000 for families. These dollar amounts are about 490% of the federal poverty guidelines for individuals and about 580% of poverty for married couples. And then finally, all other persons are deemed able to afford coverage if they can purchase coverage through their employer for an amount that does not exceed the monthly premium in the affordability schedule. And this schedule is the table on page 2 of that handout. or if they do not have access to employer coverage, they're deemed able to afford coverage if the monthly premium amount specified in the affordability schedule is greater than the amount specified for their age, family size, and geographic location in tables called the premium schedule, which is on the last two pages of the handout. And I think this is an intent by Massachusetts so that persons with no employer coverage aren't expected to pay more than those who do have such coverage. The monthly premiums that are specified in the affordability schedule range from 2.1% to 9% of gross income for individuals. The actual percentage will vary with income. 3.1% to 10% of income for married couples, 2.4% to 9.6% of income for families. So there's these percentages that can be kind of thought of as the affordability standard that Massachusetts is using. A second document I'd like to sort of go over briefly is the document by John Gruber titled How to Define Affordability. This was a memo that was provided to the Connector Board that describes three approaches to setting sliding scale premium levels for subsidized programs, but these are also relevant to sort of defining what is affordable. The first approach is called the standard of living approach. This would involve setting up a basic needs budget for housing, food, and other essential but non-healthcare costs. And once you have this dollar amount, then those with incomes above this level are assumed to be able to afford some level of healthcare premium. Those with incomes below this level are assumed not to be able to afford healthcare. And this approach and all of the others involves a number of issues or questions. This approach involves a lot of judgment calls. What categories of spending are considered essential? What is an appropriate level of spending for each of these essential categories? For example, food is usually considered to be an essential category, but then one could raise the question, you know, what about food purchased from restaurants? Can that be part of this amount or not? Some part of clothing is usually considered to be essential, but then, you know, where do you draw the line? What is a necessary amount for purchasing clothing? A second issue is how does one decide on the correct amount of an item or a cost category? Often, you know, I guess researchers will use, you know, what's called sort of market prices for the cost of an item, but they've also found that, for example, using market prices for the cost of childcare often leads to higher dollar amounts of spending than what families or households actually spend sort of in real life, because these families use, you know, other family members to provide care or use other resources. A second approach to defining affordability is called the existing spending approach. This would measure actual spending on healthcare costs by individuals. And again, there's some issues that arise. One would be deciding what level of spending to use. Often the median amount of spending for a category is used, but this may mean that that this amount is unaffordable for up to one half of the households, you know, those below the median, or it may mean that those who are below the median just choose to spend their money differently. So it's issues like this that researchers need to look into. Another issue is, are individuals actually spending more than they can afford on a particular good or on healthcare, for example? So this implies some need to kind of maybe corroborate or double-check things against the earlier standard of living approach. And finally, the last approach that Mr. Gruber describes is the policy rules approach. This is using measures of affordability that are established for other state or federal programs. And I think the obvious question here is that the measures established for a different program, different level of government, or in a different state may not, you know, quite match up to whatever programs being considered. That, I guess, concludes my remarks. I'd be glad to answer any questions on this.
Mr. Chun, you said that people who were below basically about 150% of the federal poverty guideline were deemed not able to afford insurance and are exempt from the individual mandate. Do you know how many people in Massachusetts they expect will fall into that category, and are they all eligible for a public program, or are some of them not eligible?
Madam Chair, I don't have those figures. It's something that I could look into and see what I can find.
Okay.
I think now that the affordability schedule has been published, it's been published only fairly recently, you know, we should be able to get some numbers on that.
The reason I ask and the reason I would be concerned about it is because it would seem most obvious that if they don't have any health care coverage, that these would be individuals who would definitely be likely to be incurring uncompensated care.
Right.
And so, you know, if they're left out, then that's a problem, I would think, in terms of the total scheme of things here.
Okay.
Other questions? Ms. Roden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was under the impression, maybe mistaken about this, but I thought that is Massachusetts considering out-of-pocket costs when they're figuring in their affordability, or just the premium costs?
Madam Chair and Ms. Roden, the way that the I guess the definition is, the terms of the definition are that they purchase coverage through their employer for amount does not exceed the amount set for monthly premium in the schedule. So I believe that they're looking at the monthly premium amounts. So these figures themselves, I don't believe, include out-of-pocket costs. But I should also mention that I don't have a lot of additional documentation other than what's included here, and more may be forthcoming.
Other questions? Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair and Mr. Chun, on the sheet from the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority, on the second page, it's got families up to 110,000. And then it has the monthly premium of 720. That's all they can be expected to pay. So basically, family coverage is going to be $12,000. So even a family of 110,000 can't afford a full family premium.
Manager Representative Huntley, I mean, it would be that those with incomes, that I guess that if their payment to an employer would be over that amount, then I think the assumption would be made that they could not afford coverage based on this table.
Well, I know that they are anticipating a 5% uninsured when they're fully implemented, and I was told part of the reason is because of the exemptions that were created, so it might be good for us to try to understand those exemptions a little better. Other questions? Thanks so much for the good work you've done so far for us, Randy. Lynn Blewett? Lynn here? There you are, back there. We asked her to come and just, for some of us, we heard the brief explanation of the main financing system, which I hope you'll repeat, because we have quite a few people here who weren't at the meeting where you explained it briefly. And then we wanted you really to explain it more in depth, how the assessments are made in this main program. One of the few programs that's trying to convert savings in a program to provide coverage, convert savings from the system back into financing some of the care.
Great. Thank you, Senator Bruckham. Going to spend a little bit of time today talking about the financing of the Maine healthcare system. They were one of the first comprehensive health reforms across the United States. Many of you have heard about Massachusetts, but Maine's DiRico health insurance program was passed in 2003. They project universal coverage by 2009. The primary plan is the DiRico health insurance product, which is a small employer insurance product that's offered through one private health plan, Anthem. There's sliding scale subsidies for enrollees below 300% to buy into the product. So that's the primary subsidized health plan. They have many cost containment and quality initiatives in addition, rate regulation in the small group market. They have voluntary caps on cost and operating margins for physicians, hospitals, insurers. They have a global budget on capital improvements, and they have a creation of a Maine Quality Forum, which is financed out of this program. The financing I'm going to spend the most time today is called the Savings Offset Payment, which is basically an estimate of how much savings they anticipate through the program and then an assessment on insurers and third-party administrators as a way to recoup those savings to cover additional people in the DiRico health plan. On average, it's about 1.85 to 2.41% of paid claims. So this includes the fully insured market as well as the TPAs who do the business for the self-insured market. There are also some employer and individual contributions, general fund contributions, and there is a component of expanded Medicaid SCHIP program that gets federal match, so there's some federal financing. But I'm going to focus today on the savings offset payment. This is just a visual of how the health reform was intended. The Maine Care on the bottom is their Medicaid program. Maine Care expansion is the SCHIP components, so this bottom part under 200%, the red and yellow would get federal match. The DiRico health program is the first 200 to 300% get subsidized. It's the new product. And then 300 to 400% are eligible but would pay the full premiums. Again, the savings offset payment, and maybe just a caveat before I get into some of the details, it's really fairly complex, all the different components, and I'm going to do a pretty high-level review, and if you want more detail, we can go into that, but it's, as you'll see as we get into it, it's how do you estimate the savings, and what assumptions do you make regarding that savings is really a lot where a lot of the detail is and a lot of the tension around this particular financing mechanism. But the idea is basically to estimate the savings in the program and then to capture those to fund their expansion. Now, the savings come primarily from a reduction in charity care and bad debt in hospitals. So you think of hospitals that are paying for free care providing to uninsured patients. So as you get more patients with insurance, you have more charge paying or paying customers, your charity care and bad debt should be reduced. There's also an estimate on cost shifting to other payers that hospitals do, so that's another anticipated savings. The voluntary growth caps, that should be caps, not gaps, growth caps of it's about 4.5%, so the hospitals have volunteered to hold their rate of increase to 4.5% or lower. And then this limit on certificate of need, basically no capital expansions for a period of time. Less cost shifting, and then they also have an increased physician and provider fees. They added to their Medicaid rates an increase in physician and provider fees, and they try to capture some of those additional revenues, which doesn't make an intuitive sense, but as you're reducing your costs, you're increasing your revenues through different mechanisms, and the idea is to capture some of that revenue. So there's five specific components and lots of detail on each of these components. Hospital savings, which are the voluntary limits on the increases in the cost per case mix adjusted discharge. And again, we could get into some of those details. The uninsured savings, which are reductions in charity care and bad debt. And then this, what they call the woodwork effect, which is new adults that come into the Maine Care. So as they've expanded the program, they've brought in some additional adults that are eligible for the Medicaid program. Increase in the healthcare provider fees. So there was an increase in both physician and hospital fees. limits on certificate needs, and limits on capital investment. So each of these five components are calculated and estimated in terms of the savings. This is my attempt to do a visual, and maybe next time when I come, I'll get a little bit more refined. But if you can think, if you start with the hospital baseline on the left side, and the idea is that they'll have cost reductions, and I think I need to have another little bar up here that has increased revenue. So the idea is to capture that increased revenue, and the intention was that the hospitals would then negotiate with insurers, and the insurers would say, well, you have all these savings, you have all this increased revenues, we want better rates, and that they would negotiate new provider rates. That savings would be passed on to consumers, and then the Dorrigo Health, the savings offset payment is basically to capture that, to get more people covered through Dorrigo Health, and that introduces new revenue into the system. So it's to take some component of that, of the savings achieved in the healthcare system to finance their expansion. Now, in our state, we finance our Minnesota Care through the hospital provider assessment, or the provider tax. In this particular system, they're doing an assessment on the insurers. So the idea is that the hospitals are passing on the savings to the insurers pass on the savings to the consumers, and part of that is assessed by the insurance board to fund their expansion program through Dorrigo Health Plan.
And Ms. Blewett, this has been tested in the courts under ERISA.
Yes, Senator Berglund, and I'll make reference to those court challenges. The savings initiatives there, this is year two. They just came up with their most recent, and they're still negotiating on the final. This just gives you a sense of how much money we're talking about. They hired a consulting firm, Mercer Consulting Firm, who estimated the costs. So the hospital, and this just gives you an idea, the hospital case mix adjusted discharge was about $72 million. The uninsured, the bad debt charity care, $2.7 million. The adult expansion, $3.9 million. And then you can just continue on down with the certificate of need and the healthcare provider fee assessment. The devil's in the details. So this is called the aggregate measurable cost savings. So how do you measure those costs and what goes into those calculations? What data do you use? What years of baseline do you use? They hired Mercer to do the calculations. They present their proposal, their recommendations to the board of Dorrigo Health, and they go through and approve or disapprove each component. So this last round in year two, Mercer estimated a total savings of $136.8 million, and the board went through and systematically reviewed and approved only $43.7 million. That will be the target of the offset payment. So they take that $43.7 million and then figure out what the assessment is on the insurers, and they basically have an assessment that collects that $43.7 million into the funds. And they could have gone up as high as $136.8, which is what Mercer, but they went through and they went through each individual item and they said, we agree with this, we don't agree with that, and they just went piece by piece and got it down to $43.7 million. Just on this chart, just look at the, because I'm not sure this, I was trying to find a good summary of the 43.7, and primarily it's from the hospital savings initiative. So just look at that first column, and again, this is just how the savings were estimated. Is the offset payment tax? This was challenged in the county Supreme Court or the county courts and then the state Supreme Court in Maine, and the Justice Cole said the offset payment mechanism created a fund, the administration of the Dorrigo subsidy program, and that it is not characterized as a government tax, but as a use of police power. And you can get your, maybe Keith Allen can come back and talk about that, what that means. But apparently, the court said it wasn't a tax. The hospital initiative savings, and I'll just go through just a couple of the details. What they did was they estimated the cost per case mix adjusted discharge across all hospitals in the state using their cost report data. over 5 years, and they compared the 2005 to 2003 to determine what the reduction was in their cost per case discharge. And then any growth that exceeded the hospital market basket, they attached that. And again, what goes into that and how it's calculated, but that's basically what they did. So they had a baseline, and then they looked over a period of time and showed what was in excess of the 4.5% voluntary caps and what was in excess of the hospital market basket, which is the growth index for hospitals in Maine.
So can I just interrupt you a minute to see if I got the gist of this right? They set a voluntary growth limit, and anyone who exceeded the voluntary growth limit essentially had to contribute that toward the payment that would be made to the government?
Senator Berglund, no, it was an assessment on the hospitals. This is just all on paper right now. So this is determining the savings in the system.
Okay.
So the hospitals don't really pay anything. It's an assessment on the insurers and the third-party administrators.
Right. I understand that it's on the insurers, but what I heard you say, and maybe I didn't hear you right, was that part of the calculation for how much this assessment should be on the insurers was based on how much, for example, a hospital provider exceeded the voluntary cap on spending.
Senator Berglund, that's correct.
All right, yeah. I did hear that right. Mm-hmm. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Dr. Blewett, is that, you said it's on the insurers, but is it also on TPAs?
Senator Berglund, Representative Huntley, yes. These are the savings offset payments were $43.7 million in year one and $34.3 million in year two. I think I have those turned around year one and two. They apply to paid claims for the plan years beginning after January 1, 2006. For health insurance carriers, it was 2.4% of annual paid claim. For third-party administrators, it was the same. And for employee benefit excess insurance carriers, there was another assessment. So that is how they financed that program and to collect those figures. The claims that are taxed do not include claims that are related to general administrative costs, anything that's done on pay-for-performance, or other incentive programs to change provider behavior, claims for non-residents of Maine, claims under retiree health benefit plans that are separate from plans, claims paid by employee benefit excess carry, which are counted by a different third party, and claims for persons under a benefit plan for federal employees. There was a court challenge, the Maine Association of Health Plans versus the Superintendent of Insurance, and it was a challenge to the methods for calculating the savings offset payments. It was heard in the Cumberland County Superior Court, and then just this summer with the Maine Superior Court, and it was both upheld the methodology and the statute creating the DRIGO healthcare plan. And if you want to look up the court decision, there's a link there. There have been a lot of critiques, and as we discussed, determining how much is calculated, it really depends on the assumptions and what kind of data that you have, and one researcher can do it one way, another can do it another way, and so there's challenges in terms of how it's calculated. There's some concern that consumers are not seeing the health savings, that it's just staying within the system, so it's not actually getting transferred down to individuals. There's some concern that the savings offset payment is supported by almost all, there's only about 1.2 million people in Maine, almost all of the Maine residents, but only 10,000 people are enrolled in Maine Care, so there's some concern about tax incidence. And there's some concern that the insurers are just passing on which we've heard in Minnesota and the Minnesota Care Tax, they're just passing it on to in increase in premiums as opposed to reducing premiums through reduction in their negotiations with hospitals. There's also concern if insurers are forced to bear the burden that there's some financial viability of the Maine's private health insurance market. Just in summary, I think this is a unique approach to financing. It has gotten around the ERISA problem by assessing the third-party administrators. We do have a premium assessment on fully insured products in Minnesota, but not on third-party administrators. It has been challenged every step of the way. There's a lot of places to challenge in terms of assumptions and data and detail and how it's calculated. And I think it's upheld a lot of the challenges, and it's been very persistence in those challenges. But the state is looking for alternative sources of financing, and they've contacted people in the state about our provider tax, and would that be more of a direct way to assess some of those savings? And those discussions are, there's also a bill in Maine that actually requires the insurance companies to pass on the savings to their in lower premiums, and so being more prospective or what's the word I want to use, more requiring them to pass on those savings through legislation. So that's it. I'm happy to answer any questions I can, and if there's specific details, we can certainly follow up.
Are there questions?
You mentioned the growth, the voluntary growth cap was approximately 4%. Is that something across the board, or how did they come up with the 4%?
Madam Chair, Senator, that was agreed to, and it was agreed to by the Hospital Association. So rather than having a growth limit in statute, they agreed as an association to limit to 4.5%. And I think actually the voluntary nature of that is included in legislation.
Madam Chair. Dr. Lewitt, you also mentioned that there was a, was it a one-time appropriation from the state for this program, or was it ongoing since 2003?
Senator Berglund, Senator, I do believe there's a continuing general fund contribution to the DRIGO health plan, both in terms of the lower level, the main, you know, the main Medicaid SCHIP program, and then in the subsidy program.
Madam Chair, and Doctor, you don't know those figures, do you?
Yeah, Senator Berglund, Senator, not off the top of my head, but we can get those to you.
Madam Chair. Dr. Blewett, you mentioned the increase in the health care provider fee. Do you have a percentage on what was agreed upon on that?
Madam Chair, Senator, not off the top of my head.
I know, I'm asking. One more.
I think I could make a guess, but I'm...
is there any guarantee in the statute, Dr. Blewett, as far as guaranteeing that the savings will be passed on, the savings from the hospitals will be passed on to the consumer?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, there's no specific legislation. There is a proposal in Maine right now that would put that in statute, but right now there's no provisions.
Ms. Blewett, it does become kind of a chicken and an egg question, however. If you are talking about the savings that are generated because of reductions in uncompensated care, because you have more insured people, and if you said those savings must be passed on to the policyholders of the state of Maine, there has to be a financing mechanism to create the way you get those uninsured people insured. Mm-hmm. Or the savings aren't there because the uncompensated care isn't reduced.
Senator Berglund, I think that's why in my figure it was that kind of circular... the circular nature of the system, which is you have those savings and then they try to use those savings to finance the program. But there wouldn't be a program without the financing.
Other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the certificate of need, can you talk about that a little bit more? Is that just projects that aren't done and they're counting the same? Cost they save from not doing projects?
Sure, Representative Thiessen. Yes, that's exactly right. They do have a certificate of need program where any capital investments must go through a process and be approved by the state. And so they calculated what existing projects were in the pipeline that they were not going to fund and estimated those savings.
And Madam Chair, there's a reference to this capital investment fund. Is that a state fund or is that, what is that?
Madam Chair, Senator, or Representative Thiessen, I'm not exactly sure about that investment fund. I think that's another, it's a state fund that funds capital improvements, and they basically put a freeze on any additional financing of capital improvements at the hospital.
Other questions, Mr. Fazio?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Blue, can you help me understand the hospital cost reduction? Was it a real cost reduction or a reduction of where hospital costs were projected to have been?
Madam Chair, it was a projection of the cost growth increase, and then a reduction in that increase in the growth. So it was projected, and then it was actually determined how much were they over the 4.5%. So how much did they actually? So it was not an actual cost, but the growth in the cost.
Other questions?
I have a question. You know, the program appears to be focused solely on small group, and I'm just wondering if there was a parallel for individuals, and then with the statistic of 10,000 people supported by 760, is that 10,000 out of a, you know, do you know what the potential is that could have elected to participate?
Senator Berglund and, I don't know your name.
Nancy Nelson.
There are about 130,000 people who are, let me just get this right, 136,000 non-elderly people in Maine who are non-enrolled or who are uninsured. And so I think where Maine was focused on was really working, because a lot of those non-elderly people are working, so that was their target population, was a small employer market. So I don't know off the top of my head how many would not be eligible for any program, because it does go up to 300%, and I think that includes like individual sole employers. But we can track that down for you.
Are there other questions?
Senator Berglund?
Yes.
I'm trying to understand how Maine is financing this. If I have this right in terms of Maine money going into the program, some of it is general fund contribution, just out of the budget, the RAE, normal things happen, and the other part is from the savings offset payment. And depending on what enrollment is, failures in the savings offset payment have to get addressed either by a bump up in the general fund contribution or by a change in eligibility or subsidy. Mm-hmm. Would I have that right?
Madam Chair, Mr. Benner, yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and the estimated cost savings are not the costs of the program right. or the costs of the uninsured, but the savings that they can recoup to the program. Right.
And so there would be some incentive on the board or whoever is doing the calculation to make that number big rather than small, because the alternative is going back to the legislature saying, mm-hmm. more general fund money, please.
Well, except that when you look at, they had a independent group look at it, and then they whittled it down.
Yeah.
They could have gone a lot higher than they did, according to Ms. Blewett. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, did you give the statistic as to what the uninsured rate was before the Derigo Health Plan went in and what it is now after this has been in for a couple of years?
Madam Chair, and there are only 11,000 people enrolled, and that one of the concerns of the program is that it hasn't. I think they projected a 30,000 enrollment, and they're only at 11,000. So there's some concern about take up, and is it affordable mm-hmm. for people at these income levels? And so there is some concern about the take up in the program. I don't think there's been a substantial reduction in the number of uninsured, with only 10,000 people enrolled in the program.
Questions?
Dr. Bullock? I was just wondering, sort of following up on Pete Benner's question, is it looks like of the 43 million out of the 137 million that they could have used, that none of it came out of the certificate of need piece or the capital budget piece. I think if you're, the next chart you had was just on, I can't really read those, but so do you have a sense of like what kind of criteria they used on what they were going to use and what they weren't going to use and why they chose only those three savings to recoup?
Madam Chair, Ms. Roden, or Dr. Roden, I should say, is they didn't, they basically disallowed all of the certificate of need and the CIF, the investment fund savings estimates. And I can't recall sort of why, but I think it had to do with the assumptions and was it really a viable, and we can get you some of that information, but when the board went through, they discounted those savings. And I can't say specifically, but it had to do with the assumptions in terms of how they were calculated.
It would seem to me that if they had counted them, they would have to count them on a one-time basis because...
Yeah, I would think so.
Mm-hmm. It would be just a temporary delay in the expenditure. Other questions? Well, thank you very much. It's a great presentation, and
thank you, folks.
If you would like to have your materials, please take them with you. If you leave them here, we'll assume you want them recycled. But do leave your folder here because we'll be putting more information in it each time we need it.
Keep it all away.
Are you really into paper performance stuff? Like looking at